Support for agricultural programs comes from AgriGold, celebrating their 13th year as a major corporate underwriter of Illinois Public Media's ag programming and e-newsletter. AgriGold's support allows their customers and growers everywhere to receive quality ag information at no charge. More information on AgriGold can be found at AgriGold.com.
From the Land-Grant University in Urbana-Champaign, Illinois, this is the Closing Market Report. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason. It's our Health and Nutrition Special. Coming up, we'll talk about food deserts and where people might be able to find foods, the corner stores, not only in urban areas, but in rural areas, and how University of Illinois Extension is looking to help those corner stores provide more fruits and vegetables to the clientele that they serve in sometimes a very large area. We'll also talk today about red dye and natural food colorings and some of the breakthroughs that have been happening right here on the Urbana-Champaign campus at the University of Illinois as it relates to purple corn. So stay with us for this Health and Nutrition Special from Illinois Public Media, the Closing Market Report at willag.org.
Todd Gleason's services are made available to WILL by University of Illinois Extension.
Our term for the day is speculate. Speculation is the practice of engaging in risky financial transactions in an attempt to profit from short or medium-term fluctuations in the market value of a tradable good, rather than attempting to profit from the underlying attributes embodied in the instrument. Many speculators pay little attention to the fundamental value of a security or a commodity, and instead focus purely on price movements. Speculation can, in principle, involve any tradable good or financial instrument. Speculators are particularly common in the market for stocks, bonds, commodity futures, currencies, fine art, collectibles, real estate, and derivatives. Speculators play one of four primary roles in financial markets, along with hedgers who engage in transactions to offset some other pre-existing risk. Arbitrageurs who seek to profit from situations where fungible instruments trade at different prices in different market segments, and investors who seek profit through long-term ownership of instruments' underlying attributes. The role of speculators is to absorb excess risk that other participants do not want, and to provide liquidity in the marketplace by buying or selling when no participants from other categories are available. Successful speculation entails collecting an adequate level of monetary compensation in return for providing immediate liquidity and assuming additional risk so that, over time, the inevitable losses are offset by larger profits. And that's the definition of speculation.
Agricultural programs are made possible by Risk Management Commodities Incorporated, headquartered in Lafayette, Indiana, with branches in Chalmers, Indiana, and Hudsonville, Illinois, providing independent commodity, financial, and currency analysis to its clients and newsletter subscribers. On the web at myrmconline.com.
Let me take a moment now to thank you for listening to our ag programming. Thank you. I mean it. Really, thank you for listening to the programming. And just as a reminder, here's what you hear each and every business day. We start at 8:55 a.m. with the opening market report, including Aaron Curtis, Pete Manhart, Bill Gentry, Ellen Dearden, and Bill Mayer. And then an update at 10:58 a.m. with five other voices, Joe Vaklevic, Greg Ginder, Merrill Crowley, Chip Nellinger, and Steve Georgie, followed up at 12:58 each and every business day with Sue Martin, and then, of course, the closing market report, including our analysts Kurt Kimmel, Wayne Nelson, Jackie Vakes, Dan Zwicker, and Mike Zuzalem. And we wrap up each week by recording Commodity Week on Thursday evening. You can hear it at willag.org that night or on Friday afternoon at 2:36. Oh, and don't forget that we also have a whole series of regularly scheduled analysts during the closing market report for weather. Those include meteorologist on Monday, Mark Russo, Tuesday, Don Day, Wednesday, Drew Lerner, Thursday, Mike Tenora, and on Friday afternoon, both Jim Angel and Eric Snodgrass. WillAg.org. We think it's one of the most comprehensive places that you can find information about markets and weather and agricultural news. Oh, and thank you. Thank you so much for listening.
This stock and commodity report is made possible with support of the Friends of WILL and Bates Commodities in Normal. Bates Commodities can be reached at 1-800-383-4647 or on the internet at batescom.net.
You're listening to the Closing Market Report from Illinois Public Media. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason. Find us online at willag.org. That's willag.org. This is our health and nutrition special over the winter break. Let's talk today about corn, purple corn in particular, sometimes called maize, and how it might be used to make natural food colorings. Pavel Samovat here on the Urbana-Champaign campus, PhD student, has been working to find new ways to produce red dyes from purple corn and to incorporate it efficiently and effectively, as well as economically, into the food product system. He joins us now. Thanks, Pavel, for being here. Can you tell me what you've been looking into?
Well, actually, if you see, the concern of people regarding what they eat is rising. So synthetic dyes are more and more coming into a shadow because they are made from tar, and quite a few of them are carcinogenic. Some have been banned. So Red 40 is one of those which has, I would say, which make children hypersensitive. So there have been efforts going on to source red color from natural sources to replace Red 40 dye. But up to now, there is no commercially available natural solution in the market. So our approach was to look for purple corn as a source of anthocyanins. So whether we can do that economically to replace Red 40 dye. So what we did was we took purple corn, we used conventional corn milling, and then we studied where the anthocyanins are moving in different co-products. And what we realized was that in case of purple corn, most of the anthocyanins are present in pericarp. So the thing is, if you can take pericarp separately and utilize the corn, you have economical way of getting access to the anthocyanins, and you can utilize the remaining corn fraction. So it's a kind of win-win situation for everyone. That's unlike in other fruits. For example, you may use blueberries to harvest anthocyanins, but the problem is once you extract anthocyanins, what remains is all waste. So it's not economical. So purple corn consists of as many as four times anthocyanins as compared to blueberries. With our study, we find out that it's possible to economically extract anthocyanins from purple corn and it's viable.
So most people now are thinking, but where do we use purple corn to begin with? And even if you take it apart and you have the pericarp, what do we use the rest of it to produce?
Well, the thing is, for anthocyanins, there are basically two markets. So one, health supplement industry, and the other is natural color industry. If you wet mill corn, the thing is, we realize that when we wet mill purple corn, most of the anthocyanins, they come out in steeping water. So what you can do is you can take the steeping water separately with almost 80% of corn anthocyanins contained in steeping water. Then you can spray dry steep water and get anthocyanins. But the problem here is we typically use SO2 to steep corn so that the protein matrix holding together the starch molecules is dismantled and the starch separation is clean. But the problem for natural color industries, once you have those SO2 coming into the anthocyanins, you can't label it as a natural color. So it may work for food supplement industry where people might not be concerned about what else is contained in, but it will not work for natural colors. So then we further went into the structure of corn, and we did high resolution imaging, and we realized that most of the anthocyanins in case of purple corn lie in the pericarp itself. So then we took another approach. We dry milled purple corn, and in dry milling, typically what you do is you separate pericarp, endosperm, which mainly consists of the starch, and we separate germ. So in that way, what you can do is if you dry mill purple corn, at the front end, you take off the pericarp. So once you take off the pericarp, you have most of the anthocyanins coming with the pericarp, and the remaining endosperm and germ fraction can be further utilized. So with endosperm and germ, you can dry grind it. So dry grind process converts corn into ethanol and DDGS. So the advantage in this case will be in DDGS will not have fiber, so it will be high protein DDGS, which can be used for non-ruminant diets. And other way, you can proceed it once you remove the pericarp at the front end. You can dry mill the remaining corn, and it's different than dry grind. In dry milling, the co-products are grits and fines, and you can use grits and fines to produce purple corn tortillas, which also contain anthocyanins. So that way you can harvest anthocyanins and you can utilize the remaining corn, which is not possible in other sources like black grapes or blueberries. So in this way we propose kind of most economical solution, and it's a win-win situation for everyone, because as I told you before, purple corn contains as much as 4 times anthocyanins contained in blueberries, so you can guess.
So the industry would be excited to be able to reap the benefits of a natural food coloring, in this case from the purple corn, and I'm making the assumption that it would be able to use it as a red dye of some sort, and that the rest of that corn could continue to be used as it would have been, except that it produces a higher quality DDG for use in human consumption. Is the marketplace for purple corn well established at this point? Is there enough of a market to supply very much of the need for the natural red dye in the economy at the moment?
Well, it's a very good question. So basically, what I'm working on is a project funded by Kraft Foods. Now it has become Kraft Heinz. So it's a pretty big project, and I guess Kraft gave University of Illinois $1.6 million for this project. So there is one group from crop science working on natural breeding methods to adapt purple corn to the Midwest region. And on basis of our work, we were able to provide them a feedback to work only on purple corn, or the corn which contains anthocyanins only in the pericarp. The thing is, blue corn also contains pericarp, but during the same processing techniques, we realized that in case of purple corn, most of the anthocyanins lie in aileron layer, not in the pericarp. So you can't use the same processing techniques which we use in case of purple corn for blue corn. So it also depends on corn genetics. So we are hopeful. So right at the beginning, we were able to provide feedback to the plant breeding people that you concentrate only on corns with high anthocyanins in pericarp rather than in aileron layer, because that way it will not be economically to harness the anthocyanins. So there will obviously be a yield drag when it comes to purple corn as compared to yellow dent corn, because it is genetically modified to have more starch. So there will be definitely a yield drag, but I think with anthocyanins as a co-product, definitely farmers will also benefit, because it will drive a much higher rates at the market. So it's kind of win-win situation for everyone.
And it is fulfilling a need that consumers want, that companies like Kraft Heinz are willing to invest in. And how far down the road do you think an actual use of your technology might be put into commercialization?
Well, we are already in a very advanced stage, I would say, because one of the groups has also done the economical analysis at U of I. So I think most of the things are in place, and it's for the first time in United States that we see a viable product coming out of our work. So with affluence and advancement, people are becoming more and more aware of what they are eating. And there are already published works which have proved that red 40 dye makes children hypersensitive. So doing away with red 40 in food and beverages will be good for consumers as well. And in order for companies to survive, they need to evolve. And, you know, natural foods is something for future. If you don't adapt, you are a dinosaur.
It'll be very satisfying, I think, for you when you see Kraft food products that come out that say with natural food colorings.
Yeah, to be honest, it contributes positively to the people, especially sometimes I come explain my work to other people, and sometimes people they say, "Oh, we have children," and it will be really nice to have, you know, products. And we will not worry about children eating a lot of stuff colored with red 40 dyes. So people really get excited when sometimes I discuss my research work with them and possible implications. And it's highly satisfying.
That was Pavel Sambalvat. He's a PhD student here on the Urbana-Champaign campus of the University of Illinois. We were discussing red dyes, natural food colorings, and purple corn. This is our Food, Nutrition, and Health special. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason. You're listening to the Closing Market Report from Illinois Public Media. Do find us online at willag.org. That's willag.org. Let's continue in this vein of food, nutrition, and health. Amy Funk is in St. Louis with U of I Extension, East St. Louis, that is, and serves as a health and nutrition specialist there. She's been working to try to develop ways to put more fruits and vegetables in corner stores, not only in urban areas where sometimes there may not be a local grocery store, but also in rural areas where sometimes there may also not be a local grocery store. I talked to her in the month of November. We started the conversation by simply finding out just exactly what it is she does.
Well, I focus on what's referred to as policy systems and environmental change, which basically I don't necessarily do direct education in the traditional sense. I don't go into classrooms and teach students. I actually work more with service agencies in our area. I focus a lot right now. The intervention areas in which I work is emergency food. I focus a lot on food access because particularly with low-income populations, not all of them have access to healthy foods in the area in which they live, especially if they're dependent on public transit. So I work on those issues. I work with farmers markets to try to identify and assist them with trying to offer, being able to accept EBT or SNAP benefits in Illinois Link, double up coupon programs. That's something else I'm working on right now. And corner store initiatives. So I work in one area that has very low access, but they have 42 corner stores, which are basically convenience and liquor stores. And I am working to try to identify ways they might be able to offer healthier items in those stores, as well as highlight those items.
So let's go back to the beginning of this. I want to talk about something in the language that we normally would call food insecurity, probably something you can understand and relate to, but maybe that our listeners might not know. And that's related to the whole rest of the policy system. So tell me what food insecurity is.
Well, food insecurity is where you have to worry about where your next meal, simply where your next meal might come from. Particularly, a lot of times it's end of the month, and you're paycheck to paycheck. You may not know if you're going to be able to afford groceries by the end of the month to feed your family. So. And it's actually something more common than what people think. And actually, the area in which I do a lot of work in St. Clair County, 1 in 17 people are determined to be food insecure. The average for the state of Illinois is 17%. I misspoke there. So 17% food insecurity rate. The average in the state of Illinois is a 14% in food insecurity rate. So we are considered a much higher in food insecurity rate, especially when you start working in the zip codes in which I work, like East St. Louis. Many people struggle to put food on the table for their families. So
right now, some of the folks listening in more rural areas are thinking, well, she's in a metropolitan area. But however, St. Clair County has both. You have both, and you would be attuned to both sides of, I don't want to call it both sides of the issue, but both sides of the fence, the urban and the rural side.
Yeah, and I mean, food insecurity is not something that just impacts urban communities. It very much can impact rural communities. And in St. Clair County, we have 23 food pantries that work with the St. Louis Food Bank, and they are not limited to just the urban environment. They're in a lot of our rural areas as well, and because the need is in both types of communities, not limited to one.
One of the other terms that's used relatively inside lingo is food deserts. I suspect you have some of those in your area.
Yeah, we have, St. Clair we have 13 census tracts, and I think in Madison County we have 14 census tracts that fall within the food desert classifier, which is basically low income, low access, which means they don't have, usually they don't have within, if it's an urban environment, within a mile radius, they do not have access to a full-fledged grocery store. If it's an urban environment, it's 10 miles, and so we have, that's definitely something that I work very closely on in our area.
So I've been guiding you down a path back to those corner stores that you talked about. I'm interested to know what kind of work you're doing with them.
Okay, so I have been working in collaboration with the local health department and a variety of community partners. We're now, it's being called Make Health Happen in East St. Louis. It actually started working with food access specific to corner stores because East St. Louis main grocery store closed, and they are a population that's dependent upon public transit, which even becomes a greater concern. So a lot of people rely on neighborhood corner stores. They actually have 42 of those in their area, many of which that accept both SNAP and WIC, which is WIC coupons for Women, Infant, and Children's Program. And so they're doing a lot of their shopping, and what's available to them is mostly processed food, snack items, very little in the form of foods that have more substance to them.
We know based on some of the work that's been done here on campus, the good news is that food isn't really any higher priced in those stores than it is in a regular grocery store. However, the availability of other types of unprocessed foods, the fruits and vegetables, is lacking. Is there a way that you've been working with those corner stores that would bring a better variety of food to them?
Yeah, so actually out of the three of our stores have actually increased. Initially when we worked with them, they had onions and potatoes. And at this time, our store that really, because it was locally owned, really have invested quite a bit to try to improve and allow for more access. They now are up to 12 different produce items that they purchase consistently that make available to the community in which they live and the neighborhoods that surrounds. And then the other two stores increase their amount of fresh produce by six additional items. And typically that what they've increased are things that tend to be popular in the community. So cabbage, sweet potatoes, so maybe before they just had regular potatoes, so now they offer sweet potatoes as well, and then various fruit depending on the seasonal, what's available seasonally.
Amy Funk is a health and nutrition specialist for University of Illinois Extension. We'll come back in just a couple minutes. We'll talk with her more about what her job is in the East St. Louis area and how farmers markets play into the health and nutrition of all of the clientele across the state of Illinois. You're listening, of course, to the Closing Market Report. It is a production of Illinois Public Media. You may find us online at willag.org. That's willag.org. There you'll find all of our agricultural programming. You can listen to it on demand anytime you'd like. If you're a user of Apple products and you like iTunes, we're posted there. If you use Google products, we're also in the Play Store, and you can find us on Stitcher as a podcast. Back in just a couple of minutes, right here from Illinois Public Media and the Urbana-Champaign campus of the University of Illinois.
Since 1985, Stuart Peterson has offered strategic commodity consulting and marketing services to help producers manage market opportunities and risks. The firm develops dynamic strategies customized to each client's goals and operation size. More information is available at stuart-peterson.com.
It's National Cream Puff Day. On this day in agricultural history in 1923, Secretary of the U.S. Department of Interior Albert Fall resigned due to public outrage over the Teapot Dome scandal. Fall was found guilty of conspiracy and bribery. He took $385,000 from a friend in exchange for permission to lease part of the Naval Reserves at Teapot Dome, Wyoming. Fall also went to jail for 1 year, the first former cabinet officer sentenced to prison as a result of public misconduct in public office. In 1941, Donald Kleck was born. An American research physicist, he was a co-inventor of fused silica optical waveguide. better known as optical fiber. This was a breakthrough, creating a revolution in telecommunications. The fiber was capable of carrying 65,000 times more information than conventional copper wire. In 1990, Campbell's Soup introduced Cream of Broccoli Soup. It became, at the time, their most successful new soup in 55 years. By the way, it was Campbell's that first realized that if one could remove soup's heaviest ingredient, water, that the price of soup could be slashed by two-thirds because of savings realized to ship the soup around the country. And in 2005, H. David Dahlquist, the creator of the aluminum bundt pan, died in Minnesota at the age of 86. And that's this day in agricultural history.
Agricultural programming on WILL is made possible by Farm Credit Illinois, lending support to generations of farm families for 100 years. Whether a young farmer or a seasoned grower, Farm Credit Illinois offers financial products and services geared specifically to the agricultural community.
You're listening to the Closing Market Report. This is our Health and Nutrition Special. I'm U of I Extension's Todd Gleason. We've been talking with Amy Funk. She's a Health and Nutrition Extension Specialist from the East St. Louis area. Let's take up farmers' markets and how they might serve different cultural needs. Amy, as you have been working with different populations, they have different tastes. Are you able to incorporate some of those tastes into the farmers markets in East St. Louis and other places?
Oh, most definitely. So actually, the farmers market in East St. Louis is one of our Make Health Happen partners. And she actually has a very robust community garden. And so that is also produce that is sold at the farmers market, as well as they work with a few local farmers to ensure that they're offering things like greens that are very popular in East St. Louis. And so, yes, they definitely are making sure that the vendors they have there are meeting the cultural needs in which their community that they serve. And it's really neat to see. But they're as well as growing that in their garden and then selling it. So what their proceeds from the sales of that go back into the community garden for educational programming. So it's a very cool full loop system that they've created with the health department there.
What caused you to pursue the career path you have today?
Well, I've always been very interested in how the world around us, our influences in terms of health go beyond what is happening at home, how our choices are often driven by other factors such as community and the policies and systems that surround us. So I've always been fascinated with the interconnectedness and what drives people's decision making as it relates to health. So this has been a really good fit for me.
Did you know about Extension before you joined them?
Yes, I did. Ironically, I actually worked previously for Fine and Applied Arts in East St. Louis, and I focused on a air quality program where I worked very closely with the local health departments, but I rented space at the local Extension office as part of that grant when I was on that grant. So,
how important for you is the work that you do today?
Well, it's extremely important because I'm part of that community in which I'm serving. And I think that's the beauty of Extension, because it allows us to work in a community, be a part of the community in which we're working. And I'm very passionate about the groups and relationships I've built, both in Extension, but definitely in the community in which I serve. And it's a need. And so I'm meeting a need that is important to the community, and that's how many of us can say that about our job, and so I love it.
Finally, is there any difference working with those representatives of the urban areas as opposed to those representatives from the rural areas?
That's actually a good question. I mean, there's definitely differences culturally in those environments, and there's different barriers for those individuals. But at the end of the day, I think our basic needs are all the same, and I don't see, in the work I do, the needs are still the same for the most part. It's just maybe the solutions, have to be a little different based off the geographies and the politics they're confronted with.
That's Amy Funk. She's a University of Illinois Extension Specialist in Health and Nutrition. I'm Todd Gleason.